Good morning.
I've been in prison 15 years for something I didn't do, for something I didn't know anything about. Totally innocent man. I watched my father die in a British prison for something he didn't do. He is innocent. The Maguires is innocent. Let's hope the Birmingham Six are innocent.
There were tributes across the airwaves this week to human rights campaigner Gerry Conlon, whose funeral will take place in West Belfast in the next hour. Gerry died last Saturday at the age of 60. He suffered one of the worst miscarriages of justice in British legal history. He spent 15 years in prison, wrongfully convicted for the Guildford bombings. His father, Giuseppe, who only went to visit him, suffered a similar fate, only to die in prison. On Monday's Drive Time, Sally Mulready, a member of the Council of State, paid a moving tribute to her friend, whose untimely death, as she told Mary Wilson, filled her with sadness and anger.
Gerry was a truly lovely human being. He was very sensitive, he was very intelligent, he had a really good sense of humour, and he really cared about people. He devoted the second chapter of his very short life to the struggle for others for justice. He travelled with Paddy Joe Hill for an organisation they set up, Miscarriages of Justice. They travelled the length and breadth of Britain to, you know, highlight the cases of long-forgotten people in prison. But what provoked the sadness in me and the kind of anger was the neglect. When Gerry got out of prison from the Old Bailey that time, we all saw the pictures with his two wonderful sisters and his return to his family. In a way, it was kind of part two of a dreadful, difficult life for Gerry. Like all of the men, like the Birmingham Six, the Guildford, the Maguire, they were released totally unprepared. They received very little support. They should have had professional care, they should have had therapy, they should have had counselling, and they needed to be treated with compassion. They needed to be nurtured back into health. They needed the care provided for them for the rest of their lives. They didn't get that. They were just dumped.
Yeah. What was that reality that they were faced with then?
Gerry suffered unbearably in prison, and most particularly suffered, couldn't bear the stigma of what he was accused of, being a murderer and a bomber. And Gerry never really got over it. Gerry never really recovered. He suffered terribly when he came out, and he never got over that wrongful conviction. But there was very little there for him. His family, his friends, and his devoted lawyer, Gareth Pearce. That was the support that he got. Well, he returned to Belfast, but for many years lived in the UK, lived in London. He went from place to place. He kind of almost parked his own suffering and parked his own life because he couldn't bear to talk about it, and just devoted his life to helping others and helping other people who are struggling for justice.
Sally Mulready wasn't the only person feeling angry in the wake of Gerry Conlon's death. On Sunday's This Week programme, Seamus Mallon said the Guildford Four could have been spared their unjust suffering if the IRA had taken responsibility for their own actions.
The IRA senior people who authorised the bombing in Guildford knew who did it because they authorised them to do it. They also knew who didn't do it. They knew that Gerald Conlon and the others involved didn't do it.
And they said nothing.
And yet those people were almost conniving with a British establishment decision to keep an innocent man in jail for 16 years. I wonder what their consciences tell them now.
On Monday's Morning Ireland, Cathal McCullough put that point to Gerry Adams.
What's your response to that and the general accusation that the Republican movement can make no criticism of what happened to Gerry Conlon because they were responsible in part for him being there?
Seamus stretches the imagination to the breaking point to suggest that Republicans were conniving with the British establishment. The IRA unit, and this is from recollection, I was in prison at the time, but the IRA unit, which was involved in the Guildford bombings, came forward and acknowledged that they were involved in that. And secondly, the responsibility for the detention and the incarceration of a range of people there from the Guildford Four through Birmingham Six, the Maguires, and so on and so forth, rest absolutely with the British establishment. The police there knew those individuals were not involved in those actions, and there was a cover-up, and that's a matter of public record.
The establishment's record is a disgrace, clearly, but can't the same be said about the IRA? Who knew? Its members knew they did it. Its members did not come forward and make possible thereby the release of Gerry Conlon. I'm just wondering,
did you not hear what I said a moment ago? The IRA unit, which was responsible, I think the unit which was caught
in the Balcombe Street bombing, yes,
acknowledged that they were involved in the bombing at Guildford. Now, the IRA have to take responsibility for its own actions. But let's not have Sinn Féin trying to score political points. And I again commend the remarks of Paul Hill, who dealt, I think, with all of this in a very, very forthright way in his interview in the same programme yesterday.
Like Gerry Conlon, the writer Salman Rushdie knows only too well the nightmare of having one's freedom taken away from him without warning. He spent 10 years under police protection and lived under virtual house arrest after 1989, when Iran's spiritual leader, Ayatollah Khomeini, issued a fatwa, a death sentence on him, for perceived insults to Islam in his novel The Satanic Verses. Salman was a guest at the Doki Book Festival last Saturday night, and in a brilliant public interview with Sean Rocks, he was open-hearted, funny, and often very moving. Sean asked him whether he believed his book, The Satanic Verses, was one of the first victims of radical fundamentalism.
It was one of the targets, first targets of what became a much larger phenomenon. You know, and there's an image that I use in the memoir, drawn from Alfred Hitchcock's film, The Birds. There's a scene in The Birds in which there are children in a classroom singing a song, a roundelay goes round and round. And outside, there's the school playground, you know, with a kind of climbing frame. And Hitchcock cuts in and out from the classroom to the playground. And in the beginning, there's just an empty playground. And then you see one bird flutter down to sit on the climbing frame. You know, and then you go back in the classroom and there's children singing. And you cut outside and now there's four birds on the climbing frame. And you cut back inside, and children's, and you cut back out, and there's like 300 birds on the climbing frame, and it becomes scary. And it struck me, or it began to seem to me, that one of the things that happened to my book is that it was the first blackbird. When there's just one bird sitting on a climbing frame, you don't have to draw any conclusion from it. You know, it's just a bird. It's only in retrospect, when the sky is full of birds, hostile, that you think to yourself, oh yeah, there was that first bird. I mean, I try and draw a line in the book from what happened to the Satanic Verses to the 9/11 attacks and beyond. You know? This thing that was easy to imagine was a marginal event that was happening to this one writer, from which no larger, more general conclusions needed to be drawn from it. You know, and from that moment to that moment to that other much larger moment, you know, I do feel that there's a line of connection there. I mean, I was living in New York at the time of the 9/11 attacks, and I remember in the weeks, those very dark weeks that followed, a number of friends of mine who were really quite senior journalists, I mean, really quite experienced, worldly journalists, saying to me, oh, now we understand what happened to you. And I thought, really? I mean, first I thought, you know what, thousands of people have to die for you to understand what ought to be obvious? And then I thought, no, that's not what they're saying. What they're saying is that now it happened to them, and that what had been this individual experience, you know, had become sort of everyone's experience. And I think that's true. I think that's what happened.
Salman Rushdie with Sean Rocks, broadcast on Monday Night's Arena, produced by Penny Rose Hart. Well, the World Cup in Brazil has been billed as the greatest show on earth, and for the past 2 weeks, it's certainly lived up to the hype. European heavyweights like Italy, Spain, Portugal, as well as England have already been knocked out, and we've seen displays of fearless football from the likes of Costa Rica, Mexico, Colombia and Chile. But the story that was chewed over around the world, fueling terrible jokes and dodgy newspaper headlines, concerns Uruguayan striker Luis Suarez, who was caught on live television sinking his teeth into the bony shoulder of Italian defender Giorgio Chiellini during Tuesday night's World Cup match. Unfortunately, Suarez has form on the biting front. He was banned twice before for his vicious habit and has now been ruled out of the rest of the World Cup. Well, soccer pundit Fiona Looney was beside herself and didn't know whether to laugh or cry.
All sorts of things have happened since you were last in. You were very prescient, I think is the word, last Thursday, because you were talking about Suarez and what he might do that night against England. That happened.
Yes.
But little did we think that
he would celebrate with dessert. that he would follow up with that.
Yeah.
Do you know, it occurred to me last night, I was watching that game as it happened, and before the commentators said, like, hold on, you know, I looked at it happening and I said, he's just bit him. I mean, for me, it was completely black and white. Like, there was no question about it.
Yeah.
But it kind of reminds me a bit, the whole World Cup now is beginning to remind me a bit of a really good Irish wedding. You know, like, it has everything. It has, like, you know, slightly mad music. It has, you know, colour, excitement. a kind of a sense of drunkenness with a small d, you know, that everyone is kind of high and happy. And now we have the thing that always makes an Irish wedding is a fight, you know. So we now have, you know, the fight in the car park is now kind of the Suarez thing. So yeah, it's all there, really.
Oh, it is.
Fiona Looney with John Murray. Well, let's face it, you know, things have gotten out of hand when Eamon Dunphy is appealing for calm.
We have to get a sense of proportion and perspective on this. There are guys breaking people's legs in football and in other sports like rugby, there's gouging and all kinds of wicked assaults all the time, and people get away with them. I think this is unprecedented, and he has crossed the line, and it's self-destructive in a way. I mean, if someone said to me, do you want your leg broken or badly damaged or a bite on the shoulder, I'd take the bite on the shoulder. What's shocking about it is, and there's something sort of, you know, primitive about it and visceral that is shocking initially, but we have to be adult about it, and we have to think about the game first, the culture of the game, but also about a very, very gifted player. He's one of the three great players currently playing the game with Messi and Ronaldo, and he has to be helped, in my view, and protected for his own good.
Eamon Dunphy. Well, sports psychologist Tom Fawcett says biting is an innate instinct learned at an early age, and if it's not tempered, it can reappear. And he believes the biting is Suarez's reaction to intimidation, given that Italy were winding him up all night.
We all know he's a flawed character. He's very vulnerable under high, intense negative conditions. He's extremely impulsive. His temperament's questionable. He can't handle annoyance, frustration, irritation. He's basically let himself down on the world stage. From a psychologist's point of view, it's totally predictable.
You forecast after the second biting episode, the one in 2013, that this was going to happen again.
Absolutely, yeah. And it will again and again.
Are you saying there's nothing that can be done about it? Are you saying that somebody who's into biting, as Luis Suarez clearly is, can't be helped?
Well, it's not 100% can't be helped, but if he goes into a world stage, the biggest tournament ever, where he's going to market himself for a massive, massive money move, and the consequential effects of that are dire and severe, he understands that the consequences of going on to that. So he's thought about it before, and it's not about his thinking or his intelligence, it's about his impulsive behaviour. And that impulsive behaviour is one of the most difficult things to change in people who have got vulnerable personalities.
Sports psychologist Tom Fawcett. But the excitement isn't over yet, with the knockout stages starting tonight. I'm sure parenting guru Penelope Leach has a strategy for biting. She's been a household name for many years, and her book, Your Baby and Child, has graced many a new mother's bookshelf, a real comfort blanket in those scary newborn days. But her latest work, A Child-Centred Guide to Family Breakdown, has got off to a much rockier start, with fathers' groups up in arms at her claim that children under a certain age shouldn't spend nights away from their primary carer. Penelope Leach revealed she had her own experience to draw on, her parents having split up when she was young.
I was sent to boarding school because a very ordinary reason, which I do deal with in the book, but nobody could quite think what to do with me. My father didn't want me to be with my mother and stepfather-to-be, used the excuse in court that they were living in sin and therefore I shouldn't be, you know, I shouldn't be there. My little sister was considered young enough not to notice such sin, so she was allowed to stay with them. And my father, you know, knew he couldn't look after me himself and didn't want to. So I was bunged off to boarding school. And I really did feel that completely abandoned, completely separated, and much more frightened about what was going on because I couldn't see what was going on. I didn't know what was happening to my mum, who was my main concern.
Psychologist Penelope Leach heard on Tuesday's Today Show with Keelan Shanley. The acclaimed Israeli writer and intellectual Amos Oz also had to cope with a difficult childhood. His mother committed suicide when he was just 12 years old, but he waited until he was in his 60s to confront his demons in his memoir, A Tale of Love and Darkness, which is shortly to be released as a film. He spoke with Evelyn O'Rourke on Tuesday night's Arena.
I had first to make peace with my parents. Initially, I was angry with my mother for killing herself. I was angry with my father for losing her. And above all, I was very angry with myself. I thought there must have been something terrible about me if my mother left me the way she did. Mothers love their kids. They don't leave their kids. They don't just walk away one day. So I was angry with everyone. And for many, many years, I would not discuss my family with anyone, not even with my new family, with my wife and children.
When it came to writing your own story, your memoir, you had to present your mother to the world, you had to present your father to the world. How was that for you to write that personally, but in that slightly fictitious sense?
It's not for nothing that I waited many decades before I could write this book. But over the years, anger subsided and gave room to a mixture of curiosity, compassion, and humor. If you read A Tale of Love and Darkness, you will not find in this entire book even one ounce of anger or bitterness. I wrote this book as if my parents were my children, as if I was my parents' parent. Writing A Tale of Love and Darkness was an attempt to invite the dead to my home. Please come in, dear dead people. Let me introduce my wife and children. You never met them. They never met you. You should know each other. Now sit down. Let's have a cup of coffee and some cake. And let's talk about things which we never discussed when you were still alive. Let's talk about feelings. Let's talk about where you came from. Let's talk about everything. And then when we finish talking, please go away. I don't want you to reside in my home. But you are very welcome to drop by from time to time for coffee and conversation and then go away again, which I believe is the right way to treat the dead.
Amos Oz, who was a visitor to the brilliant Dorky Book Festival, which of course is the brainchild of local heroes Sian Smith and David McWilliams. Well, over on the last late debate of the season on Thursday night, Audrey Carville was marking the report cards of politicians, but there was a D-Mob happy X-Factor vibe too, as TDs Finian McGrath, Peter Matthews and Regina Doherty took to the microphone to sing their favourite party piece.
Tommy in Wicklow is very impressed with you, Finian, and your singing. He says excellent stuff. He wants to know when the concert is. Regina, you're up next. Over your head there to the microphone, and Jim is getting ready as well.
Finian's agent is smiling.
Michael, you're going to be judge,
don't
aren't
worry,
you?
I won't bring out a CD.
You're
going to
be our
right,
Simon Cowell.
I'll bring
out
the calling in the jury votes from around.
Okay. Regina, what are you singing? All My Loving. Off you go.
Kiss you tomorrow. I'll miss you. Remember, I'll always be true. And then while I'm away, I'll ride home every day and I'll send all my loving to you. All my loving.
Fine Gael TD Regina Doherty with Audrey Carville on the late debate. The fourth French air traffic controller strike of the year caused havoc for travellers and business people in the early part of this week, with thousands of people abandoned across Europe. Lisa Cleary was stranded with her two small children in Saloo Airport when her Ryanair flight was cancelled, so she rang the live line to tell Joe Duffy that she'd no food for her eight-month-old baby.
In terms of getting food for the baby,
there's no way around here. There's no shops in the place now to get. Like, she's due a feed, like, since an hour ago, and there's not one place here to even get food.
The baby's 8 months.
8 months, yeah.
What does the baby need?
Formula for her bottles, and then she'd need jars for her dinner, and we just don't have anything. We've no money whatsoever to even get it. I explained this to the girl at the top, and she just shoved her shoulders. That was it.
Is there anyone Irish out there living that could go to a supermarket? Because you don't have a car, obviously.
No.
We
only paid 40 euro in a taxi to get here. So if we were to go back out, we'd need another 40 euro to get back out.
Because if people are going to be stuck in that airport for 2 days and two nights,
it could be more.
Okay, hold on a sec, Lisa. Anne Totme is in France. Anne, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. I just came from taking somebody to Nice Airport. Mm-hmm. And Aer Lingus flight took off 20 minutes late and just arrived in Dublin.
Through French airspace.
We're from Nice.
Yeah, of course.
Anyway, what I really wanted to say is, I'm sorry for all the people who are stuck, but I just do not understand, particularly Irish people, who go to an airport with two small babies and no money. That is just not acceptable. You have to assume on cheap airlines with cheap flights, even on expensive airlines with expenses, you must have spare cash or a credit card so that you can operate if you get stuck or sick.
It must be great to be you then, wouldn't it?
No, I'm just saying, take a holiday in Ireland. The weather's lovely in Ireland. I'm sorry yourself, but you can't just say you spent your last £40 on a taxi and you've nothing left. You must.
I didn't say we've nor left. I said we have money between us, but not money that's going to last 2 to 3 days or even 6 days if it goes on.
I can assure you that somebody will take care of you in the next few hours. They always do. And, you know, the fact that they don't speak English in Nice either. You know, when I come in, I have to speak French. You know,
I don't go and get Spanish lessons just because I'm coming on holidays.
From Liveline on Tuesday. Well, worrying about cancelled flights and holidays is not top of the agenda for Ireland's homeless. According to campaigner Father Peter McVerry, 6 new people become homeless every day in the Dublin region alone. And he says the profile of homelessness is changing given the lack of social housing and the clampdown in the private rental sector.
Yeah, we dealt with 2 brothers, 19 and 21 year olds, who left their family home because of their father's violence. They didn't drink, they didn't take drugs, they didn't even smoke. They both had leaving certificates and they were giving a sleeping bag and told they're going to have to sleep rough. The profile of homeless people is changing. We tend to have an image of homeless people as being people with an addiction or a mental health problem. And that's understandable because they're the only homeless people that we know are homeless, the only homeless people we meet. But there are many homeless people now who have no problems apart from the fact that they can't afford to purchase accommodation. They may have leaving certs, some of them may be in jobs, some of them will have families, and the only difficulty they have is they can't afford accommodation. The people who are becoming homeless today are people who would vote, and their families will vote, and their friends will vote, and that's going to put huge pressure on government to address this problem in a more adequate way. The government, in fairness, have a homeless implementation plan, and they're going to bring back into use all the empty local authority units around the country, and that will make a difference. They're also looking to NAMA to provide whatever units they can, and that will make a difference. But it's going to be only a drop in the ocean. It's not going to deal with the growing numbers of homeless people. I think the government are looking for a low-cost solution to this problem, and there is no low-cost solution.
Father Peter McVerry with Cathal McCullough on Wednesday's Morning Ireland. Well, lover or hater, where would we be without Mrs. Brown, a.k.a. comedian Brendan O'Carroll? And how would she express herself without the use of the 4-letter expletive she's so fond of? In fact, the F word features over 30 times in her new film, Mrs. Brown's Boys, the movie, set in and around Dublin's Moore Street. But not everybody is enamoured of Mrs. Brown's colourful language, particularly some callers to Liveline. Mary Cullen, herself a Moore Street trader, was delighted with the film, but George O'Reilly said he wouldn't even watch it.
We used to be, as you know, years ago, represented as drunken Irish. Mm-hmm. Now we are represented as the filthy-tongued Irish.
Why? I mean, why do you say that?
Because all he does is he uses the F word and all the other filthy words that he can, and he spews them out. On the Graham Norton show, for instance, Graham Norton laughed, the other guests laughed, the audience laughed, and they clapped every time he used the F word. Graham Norton introduced him as Ireland's greatest comic, straight from Dublin, mm-hmm. Brendan O'Carroll. And all we got, even on the sofa, was the usual litany of foul-mouthing. They say he's a millionaire of 1.25 million, and they say that, evidently, according to the Sunday Times, who did a whole page devoted to him on Sunday, and according to that, it looks like he's getting about €100,000 per F-word, per foul-mouthed 4-letter words, the rate he's earning.
Stay with us for a sec. Marie, did that strike you in the movie last night, the language?
No, not really. You must remember, it's the character he's playing. It's just part of market life. You know, there was no offence, no malice in it. It was just a bit of fun.
Sorry, Marie, I wouldn't think... Brendan says a lot about his mother. Do you really think that that's the way his mother spoke?
I don't know his mother. However, we have to take his word on that.
Pardon? He kept talking about how much he owed to his mother. I doubt if his mother went around the home using that type of language.
I think you're taking it too seriously. You know, it's a bit of fun. We went to movies. It was on for an hour and a half. Laugh after that.
I didn't see the movie, Marie, and I've no intention of seeing the movie. I'm talking about Brendan's whole approach to comedy. That's a sad thing for a comic.
But George, if Brendan O'Carroll's comedy was just all about, as you say, foul words, there'd be no one watching it. It wouldn't be number one in Ireland, the UK and Australia and a number of other countries at the moment.
Do you think that it's the foul mouth that attracts them?
from Liveline. And the real Brendan O'Carroll will be here at 11 o'clock in Marion Finucane's chair. Well, the power of language is very important to writer Joe O'Connor. Do you know, in that kind of way?
The other day I was in a cafe with my wife when the waiter approached and said, "Hi, guys." Which I wouldn't mind at all if my wife were a guy, but she isn't. To be honest, I don't even consider myself all that much of a guy, but the wife really isn't one at all. It's the latest little virus to have weakened the language, but there are others too, like, do you know that kind of way? Do you know that kind of way? Amazeballs, ledge bag, how people say that. Do you know that kind of way? What does it even mean? Do you know that kind of way? But do you? Do you know what I'm going to tell you? What? Nothing. I'm just saying, do you know that kind of way? What kind of way do you mean? Do you know what I'm here to tell you? No. What? At the end of the day. What do you mean, at night? That isn't what I mean at the end of the day. I'm only kicking for touch. Do you know that kind of way? Like you're totally ledge bag. Sup? What? Sup? You have saved the enormous effort of energy it would take to enunciate the word what, as in what is up, the shattering effort of pursing your lips in order to get the w sound out, and then the veritable barefoot ascent of Croagh-Patrick that is the vowel and consonant ot. And what do you do with all those saved whats? That's right, totally. Ledge, you ask me, do you know that kind of way? Literally. What? It's literally lost all meaning, that word, literally. My brain literally explodes when I hear the word literally. I hear it literally every day. It literally makes me want to tear out my literal hair. Do you know that kind of way? But we are where we are. For the sake of our children and for the sake of our children's children. Totes. To be honest, kicking the can down the road. Awesome. Going forward. Do you know that kind of way? On message, basically, OMG, that's so random. Do you know that kind of way? Are you okay in a shop instead of can I help you? Guys, from a waiter when only one of you is a guy. Yada, yada, yada. Hit the ground running. Do you know that kind of way? What kind of way? Do you know the kind of way people in Ireland used to speak, full of colour and precision and subtlety and wit, and a sense that the language might actually have some meaningful purpose other than asking, do you know that kind of way? Oh, that kind of way. Yeah, totes, amazing. And I know language changes, and that's totally wonderful. It's ledge bag. It's awesome. It's epic.com. It's literally mind-blowing. It would screw off your head. But if only we could learn to say what we mean, well, then we might be happier and groovier and mentally healthier. Do you know that kind of way? Ah, you do.
From Joe O'Connor's radio diary, heard on Wednesday's Drive Time. The world premiere of Enda Walsh's new play, Ballyturk, is already set to be the hottest ticket at next month's Galway Arts Festival. No surprise there then for the multi-award-winning playwright. He was a guest on Sunday with Miriam.
My mum was an actress a long time ago, so by the time I came around she was like, right, enough of this, carry on, and gave up the acting. So it was sort of, it was there, but I'd go back to my dad. He had a furniture shop in Donaghmede, and he was an extraordinary performer, a man who could sort of like, you know, who could change his sort of energy around sort of various people, but like a real sort of showman and a sort of a ballroom dancer. You know, I lived through recessions because we were in the furniture trade, so every sort of 7 years the whole family were broke, all this sort of thing. And I can just remember the strains. I mean, it was a perfect place for a playwright to sort of grow up, watching people, a man under pressure, what it is to sort of get up in the morning and try and keep on going. I don't know exactly, but I remember the sort of power of literature sort of when I was about sort of 7 and 8, and I came up to my mom and I found a poem in a collection of Irish poetry. And I read it out to her and I said, "Mom, I've written a poem. This is my poem." And she just started crying. And I went, "Actually, it is my poem at all. It's someone else's poem." but at that moment, I went, "Oh my God," the sort of the strength of the word.
Ballyturk will star Enda's old collaborators Cillian Murphy and Michael Murphy, but he's looking forward to working for the first time with Stephen Ray. Well, while Stephen has worked on stage and film with some of the greats, his route into acting was more prosaic.
And the BBC in Belfast used to have a thing on children's hour. All you did, you sent in a postcard which said, "I want to be an actor." You wrote your name and address, and I did that. Lots of kids did it. You went in and you did it like a 10-minute play, which was broadcast. Spent an afternoon rehearsing it. And then I was just a really appalling show-off. And then I had an adolescent decline, but I still wanted to be an actor, and I did a lot of stuff in Belfast. Then I joined the Abbey. And then I went to London. And I was always consumed by writing, though. So I used to sit in my room in Belfast and read these plays, Methuen, Faber. And by some miracle of tenacity, I ended up working with some of those writers, you know, Harold Pinter, John Arden, Samuel Beckett. So the writing has always been the source for me, not just acting in a vacuum. So when I got this play of Enders, I could see that it was something very new that I hadn't been in before, that nobody had been in before. And that's the lure of it, really. Theatre can still more easily, it seems, be original. Of course, Beckett is the big turning point of 20th century drama. Well, you know, Beckett said about Joyce, you know, someone said, what's Joyce about? And he says, he's not about anything. He is the thing itself. And so the great writers are the thing itself. And I think Ballyturk is the thing itself. It's not about, it's the thing.
And Stephen recalled working with Harold Pinter and Samuel Beckett.
And I was directed by Harold in a play. And I can't believe it myself, actually. I mean, it was staggering in a way. I mean, he just said to me, Harold just said,
I think it's about time we did something together.
I said, OK, Harold, I'll be fine. Especially when I think of myself in my adolescent decline, reading The Dumb Waiter in my room in Belfast, you know. Harold was an actor before he was a writer. It always helps, because he always thinks of solutions for actors. Mm-hmm. Actors always want to know how it works, not about what the...
Yeah.
Don't they?
And absolutely.
So Harold was great like that, yeah. Beckett, he was incredible, you know. Like to be in a room with him for 3 or 4 weeks, and yeah, sort of incredible. And Pat McGee, the great, great actor from Armagh. And I was playing the part that Jack McGowan was supposed to play. Jack had died, and Jack had been a mentor to me, and they offered me the role. So, of course, and I never really got over that with Beckett, you know, that I never really lost a sense of awe. He said a couple of amazing things, like one was, don't think about meaning, think about rhythm. That's kind of a foundational thought. And I do pass that on to actors. And because it's, you know, because Joyce believed literature had the quality of music, that you don't understand Beckett unless you know that. Mm-hmm. So there was that, you know, and he was a very nice man as well. From Fox Rock, yeah.
Stephen Ray and Enda Walsh, who will star at the Galway Arts Festival, heard on Sunday with Miriam. On The Business with Richard Curran, Kieran Way of Birdseye Kite Photography explained how he turned his aerial hobby into a soaring business.
Well, the technology is old as the hills. Kites are thousands of years old. Photography from a kite was the first remote sensing of the planet. Very first thing. The technology for that is as old as the aeroplanes. It was used extensively during the early stages of the First World War, but then the aeroplanes came along and it was all forgot about it, and I sort of resurrected it.
Were you always interested in kites, Kieran?
Just absolutely love them, Richard. What's not to love about them? They're just such a positive thing. You're out in the environment. I equate it to fishing. You need patience, but what a beautiful lifestyle.
I spent a bit of time in Mexico City. I lived there for a while, and I distinctively remember on a Sunday evening, all the kids would fly up their kites, which were often homemade out of newspapers. It's not something that remains in Ireland at all.
No, I think people have maybe just got a little bit afraid of themselves and their environment. And I think we've just ended up maybe creating a generation of PlayStation type children. But you bring them out. I have 3 young boys. They love it. It's an absolutely fantastic experience. And I think, if you don't mind, I'd like to read a couple of lines from one of my favourite poems by Seamus Heaney, A Kite for Avian. Air from another life and time and place, pale blue heavenly air is supporting, a white wing beating high against the breeze. And yes, it is a kite. And when one afternoon all of us there trooped out amongst the briar hedges and stripped thorn, I take my stand again, halt opposite Anarish Hill to scan the blue, and back in that field to launch our long-tailed comet. The kite ticks off, itself alone a windfall.
That was a wonderful memory. He clearly didn't forget. What do you think about when you're flying a kite? Nothing or everything?
Both.
Nothing and everything. What a poetic heart. Kieran Way with Richard Curran on The Business last Saturday. Sam Homan from Rathfarnham in Dublin has an international reputation as a male model. He was John Murray's guest on Monday, and he spoke candidly about the catwalks, the fashion shoots, and the hustling for work. As a teenager, he worked in a butcher's shop before joining Cadbury's. He was overweight then and suffered from medical bulimia. But as he slimmed down, there were those around him who saw his modelling potential.
22 years old, I was working for Cadbury as a merchandiser. And I was going out with a different girl and she sent my photograph into a competition. I think it was for the Daily Mail or the Daily Star. And it was for the best looking man in Ireland. And funnily enough, I ended up winning that.
And how did you feel about winning?
I thought it was hilarious. I didn't know what was going on. Like, you know,
would you have been aware of your good looks, in other words?
No, not at all. Like, yeah. I really wouldn't. And then her sister from that took my image and sent it into an agency here. Right. And then the agency rang me and the same thing. I hung up again going like, what is going on? And
so out of the blue this came?
Out of the blue.
Yeah.
And then they were like, look, can you come in and have a chat? And I was like, yeah, of course. So I went in and had a chat and they were like, okay, we have a casting for you. So I was like, what's entailed? I have no idea of this business. Like, I walked in going like, oh my God, like, this isn't me. All I think of is high fashion, walking on catwalks. And I'm like, nah, that's not what I do. So I went to the casting and got the job. And that was for like Ulster Bank campaign. That was the first job I've ever got. And then from then it just...
How much did you get for it?
I got a nice little bit of money. Right. I got about a month's wage for one day's work.
Go away.
Yeah, so it was good.
Nice work if you can get it. But stay your hand, Irish mammies, before you reach for that box of photographs of your darling boy. Sam says a large percentage of male models don't even make the minimum wage. From Monday's John Murray Show. Sir Anthony O'Reilly used to be the country's richest man, but now he's insolvent. On the News at One yesterday, Richard Crowley spoke with Sam Smith, who used to work for Sir Anthony.
When he was the man, how big was he, Sam?
Well, he was the man at the time. He was our first sort of
I think he was the first billionaire.
Yeah, and he cut a great style. You know, he did cut a figure that you don't see too many with. He had the private jet. He had this distinctive shirt that he wore. I always thought it was like a nurse's uniform. It was solid blue with the white collar. But he didn't carry cases. He had apartments in London, New York and all the capitals. And he had clothes there and he would change. He did live up to that lifestyle. But I must say, as someone who worked for him, he was a very generous employer. And he genuinely appeared to me always to be concerned for his newspapers.
Is there a way out of this for him, do you think? Or will he now take his beating, retire with what he has? Or will we see a comeback from Tony O'Reilly?
Well, winning the lotto wouldn't do it, Richard, you know. Maybe the European one up to a point. Hard to say it, you know, the way the markets are and everybody's moving in. I think his total debts are somewhere near 200 million. Hard to say it, but he's doing it with grace because he's admitted his responsibilities.
What's he left with at the end of it? Because the billionaire's idea of going bust and your idea and my idea of going bust is slightly different.
Well, you do go poor in a different way. Now, he's also married to a very wealthy woman. Her family are very wealthy Greek shipping people. Chrissy Galandris is her name. Now, her brother lost 400 million along with Tony O'Reilly, who lost 400 million in Waterford Glass. But I presume they'll not be, begging on the streets. But I'd imagine the humiliation of it all is very difficult for someone that proud. He was, after all, a major sporting figure. He was the highest paid executive in the world at one time, and he was the CEO of Heinz.
Did he just run out of ideas or did he overextend himself?
Overextended himself.
Journalist Sam Smith with Richard Crowley on yesterday's News at One. Mary Louise O'Donnell was on the road again this week for the Today Show. She travelled on the mobile library bus in East Cork, a tonic of a trip for those of us worried that the internet, tablets and Kindles might herald the death of the book.
I met two wonderful people. First of all, Helen McCarthy. She's the mobile librarian and she's been 14 years in the branch and she was on the bus. And of course, she's a love of reading and grew up with reading and she loves the meeting people. She says it's a job with no hassle and there's no kind of awfulness coming to work. There's all this anticipation and happiness and people and standing out on the road and waiting for the mobile library and coming on with their stories. And she also said a very interesting thing, the social purpose of it, because the staving off of loneliness, wasn't it the writer from Shadowlands who said that we read to know that we're not alone. When you see the people at their gates and when you see them sitting on the wall, and of course it was a beautiful day, or when you see them coming towards the bus or parking near the bus to get the books, there's anticipation and all kinds of joy and happiness. So she was absolutely wonderful, Helen McCarthy. And also the driver, because he used to go around these boreens, this huge big bus, guy called Jim Kiley, and he loves the job and he's been with them for 11 years and he said that he knows what people like, and he was talking about a 94-year-old man who loves loves Westerns and he gets 10 Westerns every fortnight, but you never see him. He leaves the bag of Westerns that he's read on the gable post and then they put the new bag.
Really? So he doesn't. And are they keeping a track of all the Westerns he's read?
Yeah, he's read thousands of Westerns. People have read thousands of love stories. Books on art, books on history, books on nature, books on Ireland. I met Josephine Fitzgerald, a primary school teacher, who was reading a book on cats, The Secret Life of Cats. And it was written by a girl called Claire Besson. And Claire Besson considers herself to be a feline advice bureau cat consultant. So everything the cat would want you to know about them. And I met an ex-rector, Peter Rise Thomas. He was a retired rector of Yall and he was living in Ballymacoda. And he said it was a brilliant place to live. And the more I drove around the country through the hedge groves and up the Boreens and around the beautiful satin fields of green and the lush countryside, the more I felt, my God, Ireland is a magnificent country.
It sure is. Mary-Louise O'Donnell with Keelan Shanley. Billy Hawkes has been Data Protection Commissioner for the past 9 years, but he'll be leaving that job at the end of August. The man charged with safeguarding the data and privacy of Irish citizens has had a busy time in office and a particularly challenging time in the last year. He spoke with Keelan Shanley about some of the decisions he's made, including his criticism of how Gardaí use their online information and data storing system known as Pulse.
I think the criticisms were of inadequate control mechanisms within Garda Síochána in terms of active oversight of how Gardaí are using information, including accessing information. Because actually, we must remember that the guards hold information on most of us, actually, because whenever you report something simple like your bicycle's been stolen, you're put on the Pulse system. So in fact, it's people who are victims of crime, including of minor crimes, if you're a witness, you're on the Garda Pulse system. I mean, I discovered, I think every member of my family is on the Garda Pulse system, even though we've never been, you know, in court in relation to anything. It's because we were reporting a crime, we were a witness or something like that. So it's something that we must bear in mind. The Garda are one of the biggest holders of information on all of us, and we should have an expectation that that information will only be used to pursue crimes. It won't be accessed because I'm a journalist in RTE and, you know, to be curious about what I'm doing, or I'm a prominent politician, or even more so, and even worse, obviously, that information is passed on from the Gardaí to others. And I think that was obviously the more serious part of it, that basically information was, in some cases, being passed out outside in Garda Síochána. So we wanted basically a greater focus on the governance of data within on Garda Síochána so that we can all, as citizens, be assured that when we do communicate with Garda Síochána, our expectation of confidentiality will in fact be respected.
From the Gardaí to the former Minister for Justice, Alan Shatter, Billy Hawke's ruling that the Minister was in breach of data protection rules because of comments he made about TD Mick Wallace on Primetime was another headline maker. So how did he react to that case landing on his desk?
Well, yes, the oh my goodness was certainly part of the reaction I had. But certainly it was Deputy Mick Wallace made a complaint to us, as he's entitled to do, that there was a breach of the Data Protection Acts by the Minister for Justice, then Alan Shatter. And I'm obliged by law to investigate every such complaint. I'm obliged to try and reach an amicable resolution to it. We tried very hard to reach such a resolution. It was not possible to do that. And after that, I have no choice but to make a decision.
So you tried to reach an amicable solution in order that you wouldn't have to rule?
Yeah, basically, that's what the law says, is that when I get a complaint, I must try to reach an amicable solution. And in fact, in most of the complaints we receive about 1,000 every year, we reach an amicable solution in about 20 of them. So we actually are quite successful in our sort of ombudsman role. But it was not possible to reach it in this case. Again, it was a political, obviously, context to this. And then the law says I must make a decision as to whether, in my opinion, the law has been broken or not. So I did make that decision. The minister said he was going to appeal it, which he's perfectly entitled to do. So in fact, the matter will now be heard in the courts.
The Data Protection Commissioner, Billy Hawkes, heard on the Today Show. Well, I hope you'll stay tuned for Richard Curran. He'll be here shortly after the 10 o'clock news with The Business. But I'll leave you now with a song from Hozier, singer-songwriter originally from County Wicklow and now a bit of a superstar, fresh from touring the United States. Take Me to Church. Gurumahagav Aswar Goldudur, Gudzian Chachtan Shahagin, Omadakisha, Gudjeshut Slan.
My lover's got humor. She's the giggle at a funeral. Knows everybody's disapproval. I should have worshipped her sooner. If the heavens ever did speak, she's the last true mouthpiece. Every Sunday's getting more bleak. A fresh poison each week. We were born sick. You
You heard them say it. My church offers no absolutes. She tells me worship in the bedroom. The only heaven I'll be sent to is when I'm alone with you. I was born sick, but I love it. Command me to be.